Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Craig Burgess, and Craig does a lot of things. He is the co-owner and creative director at Genius Division, which is a design agency. He writes the Burgess Letter 3 times per week. He has a podcast called Get Doing Things, which I've been featured on twice, where he just talks to interesting people around the world. Not to say that I'm interesting, but just to say that these conversations are great. He has a visual community called Daily Visual. He has written a short book called Press Start. He does a lot of things. So we discussed how exactly he does it all, and we had a great time dissecting Craig Burgess as a human being and as an individual. I obviously enjoyed this conversation tremendously because someone who has been able to commit to so many different challenges and find consistency in doing it over and over and over again is near and dear to my heart. I love this one. Hope you do as well. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at HeyDannyMiranda. I love your thoughts as always, and I look forward to hearing from you. Until then, this is my conversation with Craig Burgess.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Craig, thank you for coming on to the podcast. You were the first or maybe the second person to ever interview me for your podcast, so I'm grateful to be able to flip the script after we've now had 2 conversations on your podcast, and grateful now to bring it back and have one where I'm interviewing you.
Oh, it's fun to be here. I'm probably your least famous guest that's on your podcast. Nobody's going to know who I am. They're going to be like, who's this guy? Who's this British guy? Hopefully we'll have some kind of interesting conversation though to pull somebody in to make them stay.
Yeah, I have no doubts about that. And I think we should start off with your weight loss journey. You know, you were at one point over 250 pounds at 6 foot, and that was 8 years ago. What happened in the last 8 years, the shift to go from someone who was overweight, unhealthy habits, to someone who is doing jujitsu, lifting weights, and feeling comfortable in their own body?
Oh. Well, I guess it all started when I was, so I've always been a bit of a geek. I've always been a bit of a computer nerd. I've always sat down a lot. I've always probably was always going to end up in some kind of computer career, desk career, that kind of thing. So from like 19 years old, I used to work in a supermarket, and then I got my first serious job when I was 18, 19. And from there, I got a desk job. That was my first desk job as a designer. And that was it. As soon as I did that, because I had such a bad diet, right there and then, I wasn't really overweight at 18. But as soon as I sat down, and I was sitting down, to give you a picture, I was traveling 3 hours there on a morning. So I got 2 trains, a bus, and sat down for 2.5, 3 hours, the same on the way back, then sat down at work for 8 hours as well. All the time whilst I was doing that, I was, you know, I'd have an energy drink on a morning, then a bacon sandwich, and then some kind of sweet treat, and all the, you know, I was doing no exercise, but still eating the same as what I used to do when I had an active job, you know, and walking everywhere and things like that. I wasn't doing any of that anymore. So from about 19 to probably, it'll have been about 24 or 25, I just racked on the weight, just continued to put on the weight over and over. And I've never been a sporty kid, particularly. I used to play American football, you know, what you call football. I used to play that for a bit, but I still wasn't healthy. So the weight just kept piling on. And then I just got on the scales one day, as I guess you do sometimes when you're not really into this thing. You think, maybe I'm a bit fat now. Maybe I should get on the scales. And I got on the scales and it said 18 stone four. I'll never forget that. 18 stone 4 pounds. And I was like, This is it. This is too far. You know, just in that moment, right there and then, I just said, I'm going to lose weight. And I knew nothing about how to lose weight. I didn't know how I was going to approach it. I'd never been healthy in my life. But that was the point right there, just that one point.
Why? Why was that the point that broke you?
Honestly, I don't know. It's just, I guess I've always thought when it comes to getting healthy or making any positive habit, it's got to come from internally, hasn't it? It's got to come from somewhere inside of you. You've got to make the decision. And at that point, for whatever reason, I made that decision to never be that weight again. I was never going to get up to that weight. I didn't have any weight goals. I didn't say, right, I'm going to lose, you know, I'm going to lose 50 pounds or anything like that. But I said I was going to lose the weight. And back then, I didn't think I looked fat. You know, it was just what I was. I was overweight. Now looking back at the pictures on Facebook, oh man, it's insane. The difference is insane. But honestly, why did I do it? I don't know. I just looked at the weight. I've had many of these moments in my life where something flips and I just become determined to do it beyond everything else. It's going to happen. So the thing that happened with me, I just started running. I started running a mile. A mile was the first goal. And I couldn't even run a mile. I could only run a mile and a half, half a mile at that point. And I was out of breath. My chest was hurting. Felt like I was going to die. And I just kept doing that over and over. That was the first thing that I did. But as to why I did it, I don't know. Divine intervention? Honestly, I don't know.
Okay. So you start by running a mile and you say, I'm going to run a mile every day. And at first you can't run a mile. A lot of people then would quit. They would say, okay, I can't run a mile. I'm not going to do this. This is embarrassing for me. But you said, I'm going to keep doing it and I'm going to keep running. Why do you think you kept running?
It's just an attitude I've got. Like I said, I saw the 18 stone fall. I was never going to return to it. And I've got this tenacious thing. So I would have been 24, 25 at this point. And I'd already done a lot of these kind of daily challenges thing. I designed a poster every day for 365 days, took a photo every day for 365 days. So I had discipline and stick-to-itness and I knew I could do it, but I'd never done it for myself, for my health. So as soon as I saw this, the path was clear. I was going to run and I was going to do it in this strict regimen. I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but and it's still in my mind now. I can still see the scales. I was living with my mum at this time. I can still see the scales in my mum's bed, in my mum's bathroom, looking down at the scales, thinking 18 stone four. So that's all I needed in my mind, 18 stone four. And the other thing that helped me as well was I was just tracking the runs as well with it'll have been Runkeeper or something like that at the time. So I could see this list building up, and that's the way that I work. I can see the streak building. Day one, you ran 0.3 of a mile. Streak two, 0.32 miles. Day three, 0.32 miles. And it goes up and up and up every time. And that was it. I just stuck to the streak. I just didn't think about it. It was just a thing I was going to do.
What do the people around you start to say as you start changing?
A lot of people started commenting on the weight loss, saying, oh, wow, you know, you're looking well. That's the thing that people say. That's the thing that polite British people say. They never tell you you're fat. Only my mum told me I was fat. So yeah, you're looking well. Have you lost weight? All these kind of things. But it was never really, for me internally, I wasn't looking at the weight. I wasn't looking at the number. I wasn't seeing the number drop. I purposefully didn't get back on the scales for quite a long time. The thing I was watching was the belt on my trousers getting looser, going down another notch, but not focusing on it too much. Even back then, because I'd already built up this idea of doing things daily over and over, I was focused on the process, like consistently focused on the process. I was going to keep doing it. And doing it and doing it and doing it and until either my legs gave out or, you know, it's hardly a David Goggins story, is it? Running 0.3 miles at like 250 pounds. But, you know, you had to start somewhere.
Yeah. And David Goggins had a similar situation where he was, I have no idea how large, but 300 pounds, something crazy like that. And he worked his way slowly day by day. But you've had this idea of daily progress and daily success, and you've done the daily so often. Where does the daily idea come from?
It came from when I was 18. So I just got my job as a designer when I started to put on the weight, got the job as a designer. And I wanted to get better. I've always had this obsession with improvement. I don't know where it comes from, but I've always had this obsession, and not so much these days as I've got a little bit older and wiser. But when I was younger, I wanted to be the best as quickly as possible, like every young kid. And I was always looking for ways to actually achieve this, how to get better quicker. And I'd seen something on the internet around that time. Daily challenges were quite popular in the design community. So I knew I was particularly bad at a particular skill in design. I said, right, I'm going to make a poster every day for 365 days. It wasn't planned. Not beyond that, it wasn't really planned. We made a website and we put them on the website, but there wasn't much of the plan into that. Again, it was a focus on the process. At that point, I wasn't disciplined. I'd never done anything like this before. And there was times, oh Jesus, in the middle of the challenge where I'd be at a party and it'd be like 11:50 at night. And I go, oh no, I need to go design a poster. And I'd be sat in the middle of this party. Everybody's, you know, pissed and drunk. And I'd just be sat in the middle of the party on a laptop trying to furiously put out a poster because I knew I needed to do it. So I did the first one, and then all the ones after that build on this idea of daily discipline. And then after you've done a few, you're like, I can do anything.
There's something so powerful about keeping a streak alive and something that happens to your mind where if you do it enough times, you just want to do it one more time. And, you know, you've done so many challenges and so many streaks. And I'm curious, what do you think the avenue is? What do you think happens when you actually follow through on one of these versus you stop doing it?
It suits my brain style because whenever I've achieved something, you know, something big, like won a gold medal in a sport or, you know, passed exams or achieved something really cool, I'm really not bothered by it. I don't like this kind of finish line mentality, and something I've always had. I'm very blasé about winning something or, you know, getting good at something or achieving something. So the kind of dopamine hit on that is really small for me. So I just have my brain wired that way, that every day when I make something, it's another little kind of positive dopamine hit for me. Oh yeah, I've achieved something today. Because in my life, you know, I'm running a design agency most of the time. A lot of the daily stuff, you know, the day-to-day, nothing appears, nothing happens. It can be quite frustrating. But if I can do at least one thing that I can control every day that's just down to me, be it making an image or going for a run or lifting weights or whatever, at the end of the day, I can go, oh, I've achieved something that day. So for me, that's what it is. It's the daily tick off of achieving something. It's like a mini achievement every single day. That's why I keep doing it.
Yeah. And you mentioned the design agency. I want to go into that because you spent 14 years being a designer, which is an incredibly long time. And I'm curious, what do you think separates a good designer from a great one?
When you're a creative, and this applies to so many things these days, when you're a creative, the thing that's most important is your thinking and your ideas. And too few creatives and designers work on their idea muscle. So seeing something and making a cool idea out of it. This was popular in the like 70s, the 80s, the 90s, before computers really took a hold of the industry. People were focused on selling their amazing creative ideas that nobody had ever seen before. Originality, I guess you'd call it. Now, because technology is so good, people focus on the skill. They focus on the technique. They spend a lot of time becoming a very skilled designer. But when you ask them to do something that's never been seen before, they haven't got an idea. So for me, that's the single skill as a creative, and that can be applied to being a writer or a, you know, a photographer or whatever, the thing that really sets you apart over the longest period of time is showing your ideas and showing your originality and showing your way of thinking. That's the single thing that I think separates good designers from bad.
That they're willing to put their work out there consistently.
That too. That helps you build your ideas. Last year, last May, was the kind of the first time I'd ever committed to putting my ideas out in the way that I've done it. So I set up a Twitter account, very heavily inspired by Jack Butcher in the initial stages, Jack Butcher Visualized Value. And I liked the constraint of having such a simple art board to work with, but to show my idea in a unique and creative and original way. And every day I put myself on the line and show either how good I am or how bad I am. And that's the thing that most designers are not willing to do. They'll hide behind the technology, the skills, the gradients, the colors, the fonts. They're not willing to pair things right back and say, look, this is me at my rawest. This is just me with my idea. Just the ideas there, nothing else. There's no fancy shit to it whatsoever. That's hard. And that's the thing that you can, if you're bothered, sell for a lot of money, because nobody else has got those ideas in your head. Nobody else can approach a problem like you.
Why are you so comfortable to put your failures out? I noticed this with your podcast. You're not afraid to speak how you normally speak, and with you put it out there live so anyone can see it or judge it right there. Can't cut anything. You do this with your artwork as well. You just said if it's bad, it's bad, and I'm just going to put it out there. Why are you so comfortable with putting out those failures? Quote unquote failures.
Yeah, because it's the reps that matter. The daily reps that matter over a longest period of time. And we're talking decades here. We're not talking 365 days. We're not talking 5 years. We're talking decades. Over a longest period of time, the more and more reps you put in, the better you get. And the only way I can stay consistent for myself and to stay accountable is to put them out there every day. And I don't want to, and because I'm so open with everything that I do, like I said, I talk the way I talk, I am the way I am. That's a big part of me when I put it out there, that I don't want somebody to see the highlights of me. I want them to see me as I am. Some days I'm really bad and that's fine and I'll put it out. Some days I'm good. The majority of the days I'm really bad, and that's the truth. I want to put the truth out there. I recently got a Peloton, you know, Peloton bike, and some of the coaches on there are really cheesy. You know, it's pump up stuff, and I'm like, go on, keep going, keep going. But one thing really stuck at me. There's a coach on there called Matt Wilpers. He's a really good coach, and this is what he says about revolutions. So pedaling, basically, he always talks about pedaling faster than anybody else, because if you can keep a consistent cadence, a consistent high cadence in your practice, in your training, you're getting more reps in than anybody else. So if you can keep up that cadence, you're getting in maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 more revolutions than anybody else. So your pedal stroke is improving potentially 40 times faster than somebody else. So coming back to that whole obsession with getting better than people, if I'm making at least one thing a day, and it's never just one, if I'm making at least one thing a day, at the end of the year, just on the visuals, I've got 365 practices, 365 revolutions. Nobody else is doing that. Somebody might do it for 365 days, but nobody's going to do it for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Look at somebody like Beeple. I don't know if you're familiar with Beeple. Yeah. He's been doing every days for like 13 or 14 years. And he just sold an NFT for $79 million or whatever it was. And the stuff he puts out daily is stunning. But that's because he's done them every day for 14 years. So I'm of the same attitude. It isn't about the single daily rep. If it's good or bad, I don't care. It's the practice that matters.
You said there that you're doing it because no one else is willing to do it, right? How do you balance that with also doing it for yourself and not letting it be about beating someone else, but beating yourself from yesterday.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you step into the kind of arena, becoming, as Goggins says again, the uncommon man amongst uncommon men, when you step into that arena and you're doing something nobody else does, you're already by yourself. So every day is a battle with myself. There is other people making visuals online. There's other people doing pockets of everything that I'm doing, but nobody does it to the same cadence or consistency. So that's all it's about. Just keep, you know, just keep going with every single day. There isn't competition, really. Like you said, I've been doing this 14, 15 years now. I'm not bothered about competition anymore. I've already figured my kind of thing out, if you will.
You're just waiting for the people to find the backlog of work that you've been putting in. And when they do, they're going to be like, what the hell is going on here? I got to binge this guy's content. I got to binge this guy's artwork.
Yeah, kind of. But I don't even, and I know I've said this before on Twitter, and I always preface it by saying, I know you won't believe me, but I don't do this for anybody else.
Yeah.
I'm not bothered about anybody seeing it. It's for me. Everything I do online, be it writing a tweet or making a podcast, it's for me. I am making it for me to get better. And if somebody eventually finds that and thinks it's cool, they send me a message, whatever, I'll be thankful and grateful, but it doesn't even hit me. You know, I don't feel proud or whatever. If somebody says it's bad, I'm not bothered. Yeah, I think there's a famous, I can't remember who it was now, one of the Stoic guys who says, treat congratulations and treat negative comments exactly the same way. It's the same that I am. But I to that point, though, I have now seen that starting to happen. The most visceral example of it is Instagram. So I've been making these images, I said, on Twitter and Instagram for the last year. I've done nothing with Instagram, just uploaded the image. Just a daily rep, it doesn't matter. And over the last year, it's just over a year now, for about 11 and a half months, I had about 400 or 500 followers. Nobody gave a shit. And then in the last sort of 20 days or something, it just exploded. And I went from 500 followers to, it's about 1,200 followers now or something, just over and over and over, people spotting it, somebody sharing it, somebody else giving it to somebody else. And it is an element of that going through the back catalog and going, Jesus Christ, this guy's been shouting into the void for a year. And he doesn't care. What most people would have done, and going on Instagram as well, I've seen this. Some people were better than me and they made better content than me for the last year. And I went onto Instagram after seeing this explosion and they've all stopped. They all stopped at 10 months, 9 months or whatever. They started getting a bit of traction, but their ego just wouldn't let them shout into the void when nobody was watching. And I know I'll win that battle every single time because I'm not doing it for the ego.
Where does that lack of ego come from?
I guess I'm just thinking of the... Thinking of the Lonely Island song now, I'm the most humblest guy. When I talk about being humble, it's like you're not obviously not humble. it is just like I'm just a guy from a small town in the UK. In this small town, people don't do the things that I do. It's not this kind of, you know, it's not Silicon Valley or anything like that. It's just, I genuinely just love what I do and I like putting it out there. And I like making it every day and putting it out and just repeating the process all over and over. I just do the things I enjoy. So in that process comes kind of this almost appearing not to care, but it's just me just having fun, really. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You were going to become a police officer if you weren't going down the design path. How would you have had fun being a police officer?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I honestly do not know. I think if I was a police officer now, and I probably still would be because it's just the way I am, I stick at things. I would probably be the weirdest police officer you've ever seen in your life. I probably would have a couple of books out or something like that. Who knows? But yeah, it's just, it's weird how life turns out like that, that you see an opportunity. And for me, it was just a poster on a wall. I saw a poster to do a web design course, became fascinated with the whole idea of creativity, discovered that this was kind of a repressed thing that I'd had in my life. I'd been so focused on becoming a police officer. And I just dived into it like I do with so many other things. And then, you know, 15 years later, it's still a career and it's still on the kind of upwards trajectory. I feel like I'm only just getting started. That's what's really exciting.
It's interesting because I think one of your superpowers is the ability to make a decision and then follow through with that decision. How do you go about building that?
I honestly attribute it all to the daily challenge. If I could convince everybody to do a daily challenge just for 365 days, it would completely transform their idea of discipline. And everything I do, because I say, right, I'm going to make one every day for 365 days, you've made a commitment with yourself. And that becomes easier and easier and easier the more you do it over and over. You'll have experienced this with 75 hard. It becomes easier as the more you do it. And I like to talk about this idea of work capacity like a pain threshold. Basically, we've all got a pain threshold. Some of us can't hack any pain. Some of us can hack a lot of pain. Work threshold works exactly the same, but you can build that work threshold by keeping doing the work over and over. And because I've spent so long saying to myself, I will do this thing and then follow through, it's easy to just turn my mind to go, I will do this thing and then follow through. And also the things I pick are things I genuinely want to do. Things I don't want to do, I procrastinate on all the time. I'm not some kind of superpower when it comes to discipline. But I think the trick is picking things that you know you want to do and then sticking with them. I think that's probably the trick.
Okay, so someone is listening to this, they want to do a daily challenge. How do they go about doing it? Obviously, just do it. But what recommendations do you have as someone who's done so many?
I think, and this is going to sound like it's coming apparently straight out of the Atomic Habits book, but I've still never read it. I think you need to pick the smallest possible thing. That's what I always did. You pick the smallest possible thing that you can do for the longest period of time. So the purpose with the simple graphics is they take me 10 or 20 minutes to do. Easy, done, gone. Pick something smaller than that if possible. Say I'm going to go for a mile walk every day. If that's too long, a 10-minute walk. If that's too long, a 5-minute walk. Pick something that can be done, repeated over and over and over. And don't see it as just the first challenge you're ever going to do. See it as basically a series of ones. So this is only going to be the first one. Now you're going to do challenge 2, 3, 4. You're going to be doing them for the rest of your life. So you don't need to do everything. The biggest mistake I ever made with them was trying to do, I think because I become so cocky that I thought I was this super disciplined guy that I decided to do, I think it was 8 challenges all in 1 year. And it was, I'd never seen 75 hard at this point, but it was very similar to that. So I was going to read every day. I was going to exercise every day. I was going to do a podcast every day. I was going to make an image every day. I was going to tweet every day. It was huge, this list. I failed at like day 10 or something. Wow. Because it was overwhelming. It was just too much. So the key is trying and make it not overwhelming. Make it as small and what seems as silly as possible. Because even if it's just like, you know, I'm going to wash up every day and I'm going to write one line in a notebook every day, you get the same little kind of congratulations in your mind, the little dopamine hit from doing that one single tiny task that you do going for a 4-mile run every day, because you're tricking your brain into just changing how it works. I think that's what 75 hard does really well.
And do you track it anywhere? Do you have any sort of tracking system, or are you just all in the head?
I tend to track it when I start something. So I'll track it in a calendar, in my iCal calendar, and I'll just set up a repeating event every day in the calendar. And it'll just be, you know, if it was make image, same time, same day, 7 days, so I can see it on the calendar. I check the calendar a lot. And then probably after a couple of weeks, I'll delete it once I know that it's just become automatic, like brushing my teeth. So initially, yes. Further down the line, no, because I feel overwhelmed when I start to see them all written down somewhere, because I've usually track a couple of them, but it's very easy for me to do them when I'm not tracking them because I just do them automatically because they're in my head, like you said. So I don't know. I have a weird relationship with technology. I think it can make you feel a little bit anxious. It's exactly the same reason I've just got rid of my Apple Watch, because you can see the rings and you're like, all day long, you're obsessing over the fact that you need to burn 800 calories or whatever it is. So, yeah, not sure. Maybe for the first one, but not for the future ones.
How else have you noticed technology making you anxious?
Well, notifications is the obvious one. So I think when I first started taking Twitter seriously last year, I was at about 800 followers last February, and I'm nearly at 5,000 now.
Let's go.
Again, that was a daily challenge, right? 10 tweets per day for a year. But the wider thing from that is that I had the notifications on at first. And I used to, at the beginning, obsess over the metrics. So that tweet didn't do too well, or I'd got 10 followers this day and I'd got 30 followers the next day. What could I do different? What could I optimize? How could I make that consistent? And I was obsessed over the numbers and the notifications and the metrics. When I turned them all off after about 4 months, I felt a million times better. Nothing changed. The followers still kept coming in. In fact, that was around the time when I turned it all off and said, right, I'm just going to make content that I want to make. I'm just going to do it for fun. I don't care what anybody thinks. Everything changed. I was getting way more followers all of a sudden. People were way more interested in what I was saying because it was me all of a sudden. I kind of woken up from somewhere. And after that, it led me to write like a quick treatise of the number, I called it. And there's about 10 things on it that you should never pay attention to. And they're all to do with metrics and numbers. And we get so obsessed with these metrics and numbers. I don't ever see it as being a good thing. After being in both camps about, you know, tracking my heart rate every single day for no apparent reason, and tracking the steps that I've done, and tracking the calories, and tracking the food that I've eaten, and all these kind of things, you just build up like this low-level anxiety that's always there every day, that you've got such this huge checklist of things that you need to work on every day. As soon as you get rid of it, nothing changes. You still do the same things you always did, but you feel loads better.
You know, I think it's interesting because I think there is a time and place to track the numbers, and maybe that's in the beginning of doing something. For example, when you're starting to lose weight for the first time and you want to learn about macronutrients and diet and all that, it's helpful to know, okay, this is how many grams of protein are in this amount of food. But then after a certain point, you're able to take a step back and say, okay, I know that has that amount of protein approximately, so let me just eat that. Because you can't possibly live your life with looking at every single macronutrient or every single follower that comes in. It's a process of first learning what works and then letting go. And that's when real growth happens, right?
Absolutely, because it goes from being a very active process, something you're very involved with every day, to being a passive process. It's just something I do. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big difference, isn't it? When you start something, it's something that's an effort every single day. And I think you're right. You've got to track the numbers in the early days. But then there's the flip, isn't there, where instead of you trying to be the thing that you want to do, it is what I do. You become the thing. And at that point, I don't think you need to obsess over the numbers as much anymore. At that point, you can just be yourself and just take away that pressure.
Yeah. And speaking of being yourself, something that I love about your approach to Twitter is that you're so authentically yourself. You'll record videos of yourself with replies. You'll be silly and you don't care, you're not self-conscious about your own weirdness. And I mean that in the best way possible.
Yeah.
So when did the switch flip to take Twitter more fun and be more yourself?
Yeah, that was around the same time I was talking about the numbers. It was about 4 months in, and I decided, right, I'm going to write 10 tweets every day for 1 year. This is how many followers I've got on day one. Let's see what happens. It was an experiment. There was no goal at the end of it. And it was about 4 months in, and I was hating it. I was hating writing the tweets every single day, like writing them through gritted teeth by this point. Wasn't enjoying myself anymore. And I reflected on it a little bit. Okay, you're obsessing over the numbers. Let's stop doing that. But also what I was doing subconsciously, and I think a lot of us do this as well, I was trying to be too perfect. And how that manifested for me was I wanted to write the greatest tweet 10 times per day. So these were kind of beautifully crafted things that I was saying. But because I was focused on the numbers again, because I was focused on writing a tweet that was going to go viral, they by necessity had no personality. So what happened meant that they were getting 2, 3, 4 likes or whatever. And you can go back and look at these tweets. I don't delete anything. And then I was at the point of close to quitting. And the only thing that stopped me from quitting was the fact that I said I'd do this for 365 days. So like, Craig, you're doing this for 365 days. Let's not make it a shit experience for the other 8 months or whatever it was at this point. So like, right, let's keep the schedule. Let's write 10 tweets, but let's start it came out of frustration. I just started just writing nonsense. just writing the same thing I normally would, but I'd write the kind of thing about consistency, but then maybe put a subtweet underneath it and saying, yeah, I'm not always like this, or put it in a thread and say, yeah, this doesn't always apply or whatever. I just kind of unleashed it because I couldn't be bothered anymore. I couldn't be bothered putting up the pretense that I was this perfect guy. And then after a couple of months, that started to work, and people were actually connecting with me, and I was actually making friends. And then I just randomly decided to just turn the camera on and start talking into it. And I made a video called Imperfect Twitter, and I was kind of sick of seeing everybody's amazing tweets. I was again following the Jack Butcher model. I saw Jack Butcher's amazing tweets. I thought, I want to write tweets like him, but it isn't me. It just isn't me. I'm not like that. I'm just goofy and weird and silly and, dare I say, slightly funny. So I just unleashed and said, look, I want to start Imperfect Twitter. Let's just share everything that we do instead of trying to share a little bit. And everybody loved that video. In fact, the videos are still the highest engaged things that I do, because it is literally just me just going like that and just looking at the camera and just talking nonsense. There is no plan for those. I do them in one take and then I upload them and that's it, they're gone. So it kind of just flipped when I just got sick of it. But that only fell out of the process. I think it's important to say that. It only fell out of the process of being frustrated, of knowing that I still had 8 months to go, but not wanting to repeat the last 4 months. So I still think the process is important.
Yeah, and I think also what's really important is that you came to that conclusion by asking, how could I make this fun? And you made it fun for yourself. And I think so often we're tied to the notion that whatever we're doing has to be difficult, but what would it look like if it was fun? Is such a great way to think about doing your exercise or writing or whatever thing you're trying to do, get better at, is like, how can it be fun? And I'm curious, what about the relationships you've built through Twitter? You've now been on the platform for over a year and made real friendships and connections. Talk to me about those and what that has looked like.
Oh, it was kind of the podcast that became the catalyst for it. I built a lot of connections through Twitter, obviously met you through Twitter, and then asked you to come on the podcast. And the podcast, you have the long form conversation with somebody and then you realize that you really like the person. But really what happened is that because I was kind of not caring, essentially, what I put out, it meant that people had you know, connect with me and say, oh yeah, I feel like this. And, you know, we'd have a chat. And what I ended up doing was starting to set up loads of Zoom calls with people. This, to put this into context, this was last year. This was 2020. This was when coronavirus was at its peak. So I was locked in the house. I couldn't go out and see friends. All the pubs were shut. All the restaurants were shut. All everything, basically. So I couldn't go see anybody. So I decided to turn to the internet in this point in time and just treat it the same way as I meet people in real life. And yeah, I just DM somebody after we chatted for a bit and said, let's have a Zoom call. And then you make friends. This was a massive shift in my life. This was the 18 stone four on the scales thing again for me. Wow. Because I'd been on Twitter for about 14 or 12 years at this point, but I'd never used it in this way. I never used it as a way to meet people or take it quote unquote seriously. And it just last year completely shifted that for me. I went from kind of having a small town mindset of living in this little town in the UK to like being a global citizen and not caring about where somebody's from, spending a lot of time meeting people virtually on Zoom, doing what we're doing right now. It's still crazy when you think about it.
So crazy.
It was a huge shift for me, yeah.
How do you keep that same energy as the world continues to open up, right? So it's very easy to hop on Zoom calls and stuff when everyone's locked in the same place, but it's not as easy, I guess, when the world is open and there are more opportunities and there are more things for you to do in the real world. How do you think about navigating that balance?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen yet. Still, the things in the UK, in fact, tomorrow, pubs, restaurants and everything open up. So now we're going to get back to normal life. I'll probably be doing less of hanging out online. Right. I've already started doing less of that, particularly on Twitter. That again, starting to annoy me a little bit. So I've been hanging out less on Twitter. I hang out a lot in quite a couple of Discord communities now. But yeah, it's going to be less. Just Friday night, you know, we had a fire in the garden, a couple of friends around, a couple of beers. It's so nice to do that again. The only wish I had is that I could come over to the US and do it with loads of other friends that I've met over there and Australia and all these other weird places that I've met people, but it's just still not possible at the minute. So honestly, I don't know. It's going to be weird for a lot of people. I think there's going to be a massive COVID anxiety for a lot of people.
What do you mean by that, COVID anxiety?
Well, I was speaking to somebody the other day and they were saying they went to a pub and there were a lot of people around and he kind of had this anxiety in the back of his mind. Oh, there's a lot of people around because we just haven't been in big groups for so long. It's weird now, you know, to sit in a place where there's people. It's lovely and it's amazing. But being surrounded by 30 people is something that in the UK we haven't experienced for over a year now.
Wow.
And it's weird. So there's kind of a low level anxiety, much higher for some other people, a high level anxiety of being next to people, you know, actually shaking hands with people or whatever. I've not really had it because I've kind of, don't know whether I should say this on camera, been doing jiu-jitsu for the kind of last year, even when it was kind of at its strictest. So I've never not had that kind of human connection. I also live with my girlfriend, so I've still been seeing people, my parents and things. But some of the people, imagine, they've been locked up for a year, seeing nobody, and then going into a room with 30 people, it becomes not the norm. You've got to learn the normal again, which is crazy.
You mentioned jiu-jitsu, and I would love to go into that briefly. This is something, an art that I am so impressed by because it is the proven best way to defend yourself basically through mixed martial arts, UFC. How has that impacted your journey?
It's the great ego leveler. That's the big thing about it. I remember starting it, I think it was 3.5 years ago. 3 years ago I started it now. And I turned up to my first class and there was about 50 people in there. I'd lent some gi pants or some jujitsu pants from somebody. I walked into the lesson. Professor points at me and goes, you've got your gi pants on backwards. And I had to go back into the room and turn the pants around and come back out. And I'd never done martial arts before, and it was completely alien to me. And we just worked in groups to choke each other, basically. At the end of the lesson, my throat was sore, but I was smiling. It was just this whole weird world. I'd never done martial arts, so martial arts really strange to me. But yeah, it's kind of this great ego level, especially jiu-jitsu, because I went in there, you know, 3 years ago, strong, fit guy. I'll have been 29, just turning 30. Strong, fast, fit, and getting absolutely pummeled by everybody. 6 foot guy, you know, 200 pounds, 210 pounds, in good shape, and just not been able to do anything to anybody. And that continued for at least a year. And I'd become obsessed with it. I was going 4, 5, 6 times a week, 2 hours a night doing jiu-jitsu, and I couldn't do anything.
What were you thinking in that year when you're getting pummeled? What was the mental chatter like? And what was going on in your brain?
Well, like so many things, you become obsessed with getting good at it. So I was watching YouTube videos and instructionals and things like this, trying to figure out how to get around these things that I were getting caught with all the time. And because jiu-jitsu is so huge, you know, we're talking in boxing, what is there's about 20 or 30 different moves in terms of punches and things like that. There's not that many moves, if you want to call them that. In jiu-jitsu, there's at last count something like 4,500. So this sport is huge, ridiculous. It's ridiculously big. So the potential for learning something is amazing. And I love learning new things. So to be able to go out of the office and come to this place where I'm learning this thing that's completely alien to me, that's what I had going for me. So I'd turn up, you'd learn something for an hour. This is how the classes usually work. You learn something for an hour and then you get pummeled for 30 minutes. You do sparring and you just do rubbish. But then every time you turn up, you get a little bit less pummeled and you just keep going back and back and back. The amount of people I saw turn up, weightlifters, rugby players, these kind of people, turn up for one lesson and go home, never come back. It's huge. The majority of people who do jiu-jitsu are not big, strong people because they can't do it. Their ego does not let them do it. And that's why I say it's the great ego leveler. That's the biggest thing for me.
Yeah. And I would say one of your biggest superpowers seems to be your love of learning and your ability to stick with things. Both of those are, I think, so important to all of your success thus far. So about the learning piece, what makes a good learner?
Well, I've had the opportunity to teach as well, which I think helps. So I used to, although it's not really happening at the minute, I used to teach twice a year and I used to teach web design. So you get to see the other side of it. And when you're teaching, you understand that you need to conceptualize things, make fundamentals and all this kind of thing. The thing that makes a really good learner is the ability to find the fundamentals in a thing, not be obsessed with the YouTube videos, if we're talking about jiu-jitsu, not being obsessed with learning techniques. And this comes back to the design thing again. It's a strong thing that I believe in. Not being obsessed with the techniques and the skills and all that kind of thing, the single moves that you can do, but learning the fundamental thing that's happening underneath. So jiu-jitsu, you want to sweep somebody? Well, it's all at the hips most of the time. You need to unsettle the hips, or you need to pull them one way to off balance them and throw them the other. So learning the fundamentals of a thing means that you can learn many, many things. You don't need to learn the one thing. And then when you learn the one thing and it doesn't work, well, you've learned the pointless thing. So the fundamentals and understanding and finding them is what's most important. The concepts, really. And when you ever see a good learner or anybody talking about something, anybody teaching you something, if they're not talking in the fundamentals, you know they don't really fully understand what they're talking about. Hmm. And it's the only way, I think, you can learn something without losing your mind, because everything else is just too expansive. It's too big. And you want to learn the things that you can utilize, use every time you use it, which is always the fundamentals.
What are you enjoying learning about these days?
Design, always. So I, not so much jiu-jitsu at the minute, because I'm only getting to train 2-3 times a week, so you can't apply it. But particularly with the design, I've just written a book called The Magic Visual, which is all about the fundamentals of making visuals that get noticed on the internet. So what I had to do for that, this is why I enjoy writing books so much. I'm not much of a writer, but I enjoy writing books for this process, is what I really enjoy doing it is conceptualizing things and naming things and breaking things down into fundamentals that haven't previously been broken down somewhere else. So there's a lot of that that's going on in the magic visual. So when I'm learning something, even with the visuals, I'll be making a visual and I'll go, right, okay, that thing works in a visual. So I'll call that a new visual pattern and I'll give it a name. And now you see it and now you don't, or whatever. And then in a few months' time, I'll use the same pattern, the same fundamental for another visual. And I'll do the same thing over and over and over. You can see this most obviously in memes. So, you know, when you look at memes, the particular memes, they're always the same image or whatever. You know, you spot the same pattern over and over. They're all visual patterns. And the reason that they work is because the person recognizes the same image, the same format over and over and over. So I enjoy looking for that. Memes are a particular obsession of mine right now, looking to try and conceptualize them and actually use them to either build engagement or use them purposefully. I've been messing with a couple the last couple of days on Twitter, and they've done really well because it's a pattern. It's just another visual pattern.
That's so fascinating. I never thought about it like that, that the reason why memes are successful and easily spreadable is because you're not doing work as the consumer. You already know the image for the most part, if you've seen it once before, and you're able then to understand what the artist is trying to say quickly and more efficiently. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's kind of two levels to a meme, and it's the same with a visual. In fact, I wish I put a bit in the memes. I wish I'd learned this bit so I could put it in the magic visual, but I didn't. So there's two levels to a meme. There's the recognizing what's going on. Mm-hmm. So this is why they always use the same image or the same structure or whatever. And in that moment, you recognize it. You go, oh, I've seen this before. And then the second level is the words that are on it. And that's when you figure the things out. So I like to call this creating the simplest puzzle in the world. So when you're making a visual, you want to put something in there where they've got to work out, where they feel like they're solving a thing and they get this little dopamine hit and they either smile, laugh, or go, ah, that kind of thing. So the memes work on two levels like that. First of all, you recognize the image, so it makes you stop because you've seen it before. That's how everything works. Then the second level is you read it and there's a kind of a half a second of you working out what's going on. And then you laugh, smile, get angry, feel clever. And in that moment there, you hit share. Yeah. You hit retweet or you share it with a friend. If you miss either one of those points, it doesn't get shared. But the reason memes work so well is because the format is so strict for most of them. They're using the same image over and over. So it's easy. It's an easy format to replicate over and over. A lot of people aren't using them for the power that they could, because they could be used in serious settings as well. I often use them. I wrote a thread on Twitter the other day, taking the piss out of Twitter threads. So the serious point was I'm sick of reading Twitter threads, but I made the point by using memes. So they were all memes of Twitter threads. And it does really well in that instance because it's so niche, if I want to say the American word. It's so niche that people understand something from somewhere else, that they're like the 12-year-old, uncle or 12-year-old uncle, 12-year-old sister or whatever sent you, but they've seen it in a different medium. And it just accelerates that understanding. They're fascinating memes.
It also allows you to remember the information better. If you have two pieces of content and one of it is straight up text and the other is in a meme, the second one is going to be more easily recognized by your brain and able to recall that better. So I think that plays a part in it as well. in addition to the shareability aspect of it.
Absolutely. It's why visualized value became so popular. Yeah. And visualized value isn't the only one that's popular. There's other ones that you're probably not familiar of. Behavior Gap, Liz and Molly. There's a whole load of visual accounts that are really popular. But the reason they're all so popular is because they're simplifying, like you said, they're simplifying something that's quite difficult or abstract to understand, and they're putting it in an image. But the magic isn't just the image. The magic is the text and the image. So when they both go together, you get the same aha moment like you get with memes. You look at the image, you see the text, and you try to, and this is most visceral with visualized value images, you see the text, you see the image, and then in your brain, you try to slot them over the top of each other. And in that moment, you go, oh, that's clever, I get it. And then you share it. That's, again, that magic moment. It's why visuals are so powerful. And we're only just hitting the surface of it with Twitter specifically.
What makes someone a good meme creator?
That's a hard one. I think it's the same thing that makes people good at writing tweets. You've got to find the truth that everybody is thinking, but nobody is saying. And that isn't easy to do. But particularly with my visual images, the unobvious account, the kind of visualized value stuff, I tend to take really old fundamental concepts, stoicism or whatever philosophy I find, and modernize it with an image. With kind of a meme and other things, you're kind of doing the same thing. You're looking for the principles, the fundamentals of a way of thinking or something that people are saying, but they're not putting into tweets. They're truly magical when you can find that moment. The harsher you can make them, the more they spread virally. But the bonus you've got with a visual, particularly a meme, is they don't look harsh because they're just taking the, you know, they're taking the piss out of the situation. They're making fun of the situation. So they don't look harsh. Whereas if I would have, to go back to the thread that I made of basically saying I hate threads, if I would have just written 10 tweets about how I hate threads, I'd look like a grumpy guy. But because I use memes, people like it. So you could, they're very passive aggressive, actually. You can hide harsh truths inside memes and visuals. They hit a lot different. And the other thing to say on that, the reason they hit a lot different is, and this is the magic of them, is that people don't think they apply to them. And that's why they share them. Even though they've experienced it many times in their life, topics like procrastination, a lack of discipline, sticking to things, all that kind of stuff, people always share it because they don't think it applies to them.
It makes someone feel better in the moment about themselves, saying, I am not this, or I am this and you're not. And that's why I'm sharing it.
Yeah. The reason somebody shares something is for a multitude of reasons, but it's because they want to get something out of the situation. So what I like to say about this, it's either the image has either made them angry, it's either made them laugh, it's either made them think deeply about their own existence, or it's made them think, or it's appeared clever or whatever. So if you take those five instances, if, for example, you made a clever visual and somebody gets it, so I'm there looking at this visual and going, oh, I get that. I now want to share that because I want to show how clever I am by sharing it with other people to see if they get it. And then if they don't get it, I feel superior to them. So that's what's happening when these things kind of get shared. So any kind of visual that you make has got to kind of elicit a harsh, strong reaction in somebody. Not necessarily harsh, but, you know, strong reaction. Because if it doesn't get shared. But that's like anything online, isn't it? It's got to be polarized. It's got to be either really, really funny or really harsh. The things in the middle, the mediocrity, it doesn't get shared.
It's fascinating stuff, man. It's like you break down the something that I really haven't spent much time thinking about, memes, into the component parts, the fundamentals, which is so cool to hear, because that's obviously another reason for all of your success is that you're able to break down and wanting to break down different things to those levels. Before we wrap up here, I want to ask about the future. Where is Craig Burgess 14 years from now? You spent 14 years becoming a designer, and I'm curious where you foresee yourself 14 years from now, and we can pull up this clip in 2035.
Do another podcast.
For sure.
Honestly, I don't know. I'm going to nick your answer from one of your podcasts that I was listening to that we spoke about on my podcast when somebody asked you, you know, what are you doing and what do you want to do in the future? And you just said that the thing I'm most focused on is making this podcast video right now. Exactly the same for me. I spend my time living in the present. That's why I have the daily challenges. So I can just make the thing, move to the next day, make the thing, move to the next day. And what that process usually ends up falling out is things that I may want to do over a longer period of time. Maybe start a community, which I've done, or write a book or make a course or whatever. But there is no grand plan.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'll be a designer in 15 years. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. But I've already started shifting away quite strongly from that persona. I do so many other things. I record a podcast. I do YouTube videos. I make visuals. It's one component part of it. I write books. I run a design agency. There's so many aspects that it's hard to say where I'll be. I hope in maybe 10 or 15 years' time, this idea of a full stack creator is a really strong term. I hate the term personally, but this kind of Swiss Army knife of creator, I'll be making something. I don't know what it's going to be though.
I love it. Where do you have any final closing pieces of wisdom or information that you'd like to get out in the world?
I'd really hope that after listening to us talk about daily challenges and doing something every day for a long period of time, that somebody goes out, even gives one a try for 7 days, because they will absolutely change your life. There is so much kind of data, and if you care about that kind of thing, so much data and research and evidence about why they work and how they work. If you look at behind the success of pretty much any athlete, actor, professional, they have furiously practiced daily for a really long period of time. So just do something daily. That's all I want to say. That's the only wisdom I have. That's the only thing I've ever done. The only fundamental I've followed, and it's not done me too bad.
I love it. And it is wise words indeed. Where can people find more from Craig Burgess?
Just go to my website, getdoingthings.com, or I'm on Twitter as well, but the link's on there, which is, I'm just Craig Burgess on Twitter. But yeah, go to my website for more nonsense and good fun.
Go follow a wild Craig. Thank you, Craig, for the incredible conversation. I really appreciate you.
No worries, man. Thanks a lot.
Episode with Craig Burgess. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Looking forward to hearing from you, and just wanted to give you a final thank you for listening. I release these episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and whenever anyone gets to the end of any of these episodes, I always feel a sense of warmth and appreciation. So thank you. I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.